Hello and welcome to the last ever episode of the Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bound. We're bidding the show farewell, but we'll give you a bit more information about that later. It's going to be a stellar lineup of TV, film and music today. In the studio, I'm going on a Netflix binge with the writer Lucy Jones and the TV editor for the Evening Standard and London Live, Toby Earle. We'll meet the singer-songwriter Ricky Lee Jones and we'll have the biggest global countdown to date later on with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. So stick around for the Arts Review right here on Monocle 24. Lucy and Toby, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Lovely to have you around the desk on our kind of our final voyage of the Arts Review in its current state.
An honour.
Yeah, it's good. We kind of saved the best for last.
Oh.
In some ways.
Oh.
No, we're going to talk about some great TV and we've got some great people to talk about it. Come on, it's going to be fine. And also, I think you guys have done this show once before together.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't why it's the format's ending, is it? We did it once the other before.
Yeah, exactly.
That was it.
You've closed the radio station down. I don't know how to say this in any other more subtle way than that. But it sounds like you're getting on like a house on fire. I'm talking about holidays to Sri Lanka. I've got pictures of Wales on my phone, etc., etc. If only we could play the preliminary chat as part of the programme, we'd be doing okay. Because we're going to slightly less happy shores to start with. Shall we play a clip? This is new to Netflix. It's called Annihilation.
He was extremely ill.
You have to tell me where he was, what he was doing.
It was his decision to go in. It's something they termed the Shimmer.
We've sent in drones and teams of people,
but nothing comes back.
But something has.
You're a biologist.
He served in the military.
If I knew what happened, I could save his life.
The boundary's getting bigger. It's expanding. We're talking cities, states.
You need to know what's inside.
And that was a little taste of Annihilation, new to Netflix. Toby, talk us through this one. Alex Garland's behind it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not, as you can hear, it's not an Adam Sandler comedy. It's not.
It's about as funny as some of his later ones.
Very true.
Sorry.
Less bodily function gags, I would say. Picture this. A film called Annihilation, written and directed by Alex Garland, starring Natalie Portman, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Tessa Thompson, very of the moment,
yeah.
And a bit of Oscar Isaac in there as well.
Yes, I saw him kind of looking a bit sad and lonely in the jungle.
Yeah, a little bit peaky as well. Have that in your mind, right? You've got some really exciting actors.
Uh-huh.
You've got a director and writer who I think is always fascinating, Ex Machina. He wrote The Dread film, which for me is one of the best sci-fi films and absolute yonks. Ex Machina lauded. It's on Netflix. We don't get to see it at the pictures. It's arrived, dumped straight into our Netflix boxes. Has had a limited theatrical release in the States. And people will now, in this country and the rest of the world, be able to watch this on their phone. That is a travesty. That is an absolute travesty.
Is it shot as a movie? Is it wasted as a TV show?
It's completely wasted. It's a theatrical film that Paramount had a bit of a wobble about.
Right.
Test audiences, creative differences. It is not your usual sci-fi film, as I say. Alex Garland, Ex Machina, more thoughtful, less laser guns and crazy aliens sort of disemboweling people on a large scale. It is a little bit more thoughtful than that, somewhat more cerebral. That is not to say it is without action. But here's what happened. It turns out that there was a bit of a wobble. Paramount struck the deal with Netflix for it to be released globally through Netflix, while there was a limited theatrical run in the States and Canada and China, I think. Hasn't done great numbers at the box office, to be fair. So people then say, well, they made a great decision. This is not made to be seen on a TV.
I seem to remember getting a press invitation to see this as a press screening for a cinema release. Actually.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it should be seen because the visuals are hypnotic. They radiate. You heard something they described as the shimmer, which is this, I should explain.
It's a dance.
It's a dance.
No,
I mean, I'm trying to replicate it now, not doing too good a job. But it's this strange zone, a classified zone, where military expeditions have gone missing. No one's quite sure what's taking place within it. But it's kind of like it kind of has that effect that you get when you see oil or petrol in water, that kind of rainbowy effect, but it's kind of very, very vivid, very stark, but there is something unnatural about it. So this team of scientists, an all-female team of scientists, again, a refreshing change in a sci-fi flick to have a team of, you know, women on a mission, not men on a mission, go into this zone to find out what's happened. And Natalie Portman's husband had gone in there and has come back and he's not good, not doing well. But, as I say, big sci-fi flick should be seen on a big screen. And I think there are some sort of screenings which are trying to be arranged at the moment in London to try and give it the life it deserves. But this is a situation now because Netflix are picking up films.
Did this sort of happen with the Cloverfield film, didn't it?
Yes.
It's a similar sort of thing, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what happens? I mean, it's a funny thing. What happens to big stars like Natalie Portman? And I mean, who's the leader of the pack for this project? What happens to that? What happens with the promise of being in cinemas and all the rest of it? What does it do to the brand of something like that? Clearly, we know that TV is the movies of maybe 20 years ago in terms of kind of pulling power and all the rest of it. But I wonder what that does to people's deals, distribution, all the rest of it. It's so complicated. I'm amazed that something can suddenly switch and play for another team.
Yes,
yeah. Really.
Right? Well, I mean, it has been pointed out that Paramount had a bit of a shocking year at the box office and they had taken some creative risks. Mother, Aronofsky's Mother, didn't do too well at the box office. Downsizing, the Matt Damon film again, didn't perform too well. And that was as if, all right, we've taken our risks. We can't do another. But at the same time, you think, well, this shouldn't just be thrown in because of a bad financial year somehow. I know, obviously, I'm not the one who has to foot the bill at the end of it, but it does feel as if this could stand on its own 2 feet and be seen, particularly in the UK with Alex Garland being a British lad. Do you think a homegrown audience would be into it? I did read an article sort of talking about this, and there was a phrase in it that really struck me. It talked about Netflix being seen as a safe space for potentially toxic assets. That does Netflix no favours.
It's not very good, is it?
That does Netflix no favours. And it may be so that, you know, the studios have pumped a lot of money into films. Bad test screenings. You know how word of mouth gets around once they start taking place. Reshoots, tra-la-la. But that does Netflix no good if they start to take on these films that, you know, aren't deemed good enough to be put out in theatres. But they can say, but we've got the latest so-and-so film. We've got the latest so-and-so film. If they're not genuinely good.
It's a funny thing. I mean, this was what Netflix was before it went into content production and original series and stuff. It was a repository for quite a lot of bad stuff. You know, but if you you don't have to go very far down the menu to kind of find some funny old stuff on there that you've never heard of. You want that you search for something and it'll be films like such and such.
Yep.
And this will be maybe. I mean, but this is the real deal. This isn't something like Coma or something. This is something proper.
This is, I mean, you think of some other films that maybe got released in you know, the last year or so, something like Flatliners.
Yeah.
The Murder on the Orient Express remake. It's like, how have they found the time and the money and the commitment to be put on a big screen? And something like this, which is made by an exciting filmmaker, features an all-female, pretty much an all-female cast. So I'm not saying it's just worthy because it's zeitgeisty at the moment. They're there on merit. How can that not be seen as something that they should be doing? And it's, you know, it is. I think, again, it's a symptom of the mid-budget film being squeezed out and really not, I don't know, having the support that it should do.
It's an interesting one. I guess this will happen. This isn't the first time this will happen. It's not the first time, and it won't be the last that this happens. But it's a funny one for the brand of the distributor and certainly for the cast and for Alex Garland himself. You know, a great filmmaker, a great writer. Maybe they should have got some All Saints to do the music. Then we'd be back on your Sri Lankan beach or somewhere near it. Everything would be fine. Okay. Well, Toby, thank you very much for kind of giving us a story behind the story on Annihilation. But it's worth, anyway, if we have a Netflix account, it is worth watching. Just sit very close to the TV, is what you're saying, or very close to your phone on the train and the way to work in the morning.
If you watch this on your phone, I'm going to find you.
You're going to personally come round?
Yeah.
Okay. Don't make Toby angry. Okay, that is Annihilation. Screening now. We wonder why. We know why, but we are sad to say why on Netflix. Nonetheless, check it out. Watch on the biggest screen you possibly can. Next, we're going to talk about The Defiant Ones. This is a documentary strand, Lucy. This sounds like fascinating stuff. Let's whet our listeners' appetite and have a little clip.
All I remember is that Drea came in to play us the chronic. I said, who recorded this for you? He said, me. I said, wow. This guy will define Interscope.
Jimmy was like, I want to get you guys on the cover of the Rolling Stones magazine. You guys are like Mick and Keith. I'm like, who the fuck is Mick and Keith? Fuck the Rolling Stone magazine. I want to be on the Source magazine cover. That is hip-hop supremacy. That motherfucker blew up. I mean, I ain't never had that many white people come to me in my whole life.
Oh, Snoop Dogg on pretty mean form there, not knowing who Mick and Keith are. This looks like such good stuff, such a great subject for a documentary. Who are the Defiant Ones? What's this about, Lucy?
So the Defiant Ones is a four-part documentary made by Alan Hughes of the Hughes brothers, who started his career making Menace to Society and Dead Presidents. And this is one of his first solo projects without his twin, Albert. And just a bit of background about him. So he started out, actually before Menace to Society, making music videos for Tupac and NWA, and he's from Compton. So he was friends with Dr. Dre kind of 25 years ago. And The Defiant Ones started out as a documentary about Dre, which Alan Hughes wanted to make. And then he decided to change it into a look at the partnership between Dre and Jimmy Iovine, who's the Interscope head, who is known for basically kind of starting the careers of anyone you want to name.
Yeah.
Patti Smith, Tom Petty, Stevie Nicks, Eminem, Lady Gaga. I mean, really big music
Fairly
stars.
Fairly Catholic taste, you might say.
Exactly, exactly. And the interesting thing about Iovine is that he was in the kind of gangster rap scene early on, but he also had this rock thing going on as well. Anyway, so the culmination of their partnership, and the four-part series does tell it chronologically, was the massive Beats Apple deal. So they sold Beats to Apple in 2014 for $3 billion. So it was the biggest acquisition in Apple's history. And the story kind of follows the two of them from the very beginning through NWA, then through Dre's kind of work with Eminem and Iovine's incredible record production all the way through, and then looks at how the kind of music industry started to almost die in a way.
Yeah.
And Beats came in. But there are three things which make it especially amazing. Number one, Dr.
Dre.
I
like the way, by the way, listeners, I like the way Lucy holds up a qualification with all three fingers aloft.
Yeah.
Okay, qualification one. What's
okay.
the but?
Well, firstly, you might hear, I heard about this and I thought, oh, it's, it could be an ego stroke of Dr. Dre. You know, how is it not going to be a puff piece with Alan Hughes having been friends with them for 25 years? Okay, here we go. Number one, Dr. Dre. Any fans of Dre know that he doesn't talk to press. He doesn't do interviews. He's enigma. He's mysterious. Fans of Dre have been waiting for the album Detox for like 15 years. And this is the first time we've seen him on screen really revealing himself. And it's a really revealing portrait of him. So, for example, he talks about the Dee Barnes assault from 94, where he assaulted the music journalist Dee Barnes, and she also is in the story. And that's something that Straight Outta Compton, the film that came out a couple of years ago, didn't address. And so that's really interesting. Number two, okay, this is a music lover's fantasy. The amount of footage that he has unearthed.
And there's so many good talking heads on this, right?
So many good talking heads, but it's not, you know how with music documentaries, it's always the talking heads, and the talking heads are amazing. But this is, and this is going into my third point, the aesthetic and the style of how it is made is next level. It reminds me of like Scorsese, like The Wolf of Wall Street and Big Short. It's kind of rapid cut shots and scenes, interviews with talking heads like Patti Smith, Gaga, Eminem, these super famous people, all kind of layered on each other. I'm sure there are really technical kind of filmic terms for the way it's edited and shot, but it's just incredibly vibrant and compelling and engaging. It's not a two-dimensional story. It really pulls you in. So he does things like Jimmy Iovine will be saying, go, 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 about something, and he'll splice it into 50 Cent going, go, 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 at the beginning of that's the famous song, which is, I've forgotten the name. You know, it's just like, it's just really cleverly done.
And it seems to kind of mix up the business side, you know, unconventionally as well, with kind of like the genesis of songs, the genesis of whole kind of like genres and stuff. It's quite good to skip between all of those things with quite fleet feet, right? Which is quite a rare thing to do. It's not like this is the kind of, and you don't feel cynical maybe about the kind of Beats deal after you see where how these guys grow up, how committed they are to their art and the relationship they have with the press and with the police and all sorts of things. You kind of want to pat them on the back at the end of it rather than going, oh man, they sold out. You know?
Definitely. I mean, essentially, it's also a narrative of the American dream.
Mm.
And also, it's a portrayal of two extraordinary geniuses, you know, who do nothing but work and are in the Malcolm Gladwell 1,000 hours
yeah, right.
type, and they've got grit and they, you know, they have their standards are like higher than anyone else's. And so, yeah, when the deal comes, I mean, in a way, I felt a bit kind of forlorn because I mean, I used to be a music journalist and yeah, I mean, it's business.
Because
isn't
you're seeing the end of the yeah, sort of the, such a great change that it looks like the end of the old music industry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they were so brilliant that they predicted that
yeah,
years before it happened and they started.
They could have told
going.
You, Lucy, that's the thing. Could have told all of us.
I know.
I know it's nice seeing Dre wandering around with his bag of CDs.
Yeah.
Right? And you're kind of, you know, kind of going, no one will come and play this thing and no one will give him a fair kind of trial kind of thing on that record,
yeah.
Chronic, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And seeing footage like that and even, you know, NWA in the studio recording F the Police, you know,
yeah,
the footage of that which no one has actually ever seen before, and there's lots of stuff like that. There's footage of Tupac that I'd never seen before. There's like Dre listening to some Marvin Gaye, the Isolated Stems, which no one's seen before. Like, they really, Alan Hughes worked really hard to go into the archives deep and find stuff that, you know, there's the footage of My Name Is, Eminem's first song.
Yeah.
That was the first single I ever bought, actually. And it's the two of them working it out together. You're watching the genesis of that
yeah,
song. And it's magic. It's a really amazing piece of work.
The Defiant Ones is a Netflix production, a little bit like The Annihilation. But maybe it's meant to be there. Anyway, we have a short interview on the subject with the director, Alan Hughes. He spoke to Ben Rylan about making the film and how he handled the controversial topics in Dr. Dre's past.
I think with Dre, we had a lot of history. I've also known Dre for 25 years. And, you know, I was a product of a mother that, you know, had me in therapy at 8 years old, you know, and I've been in therapy off and on for all those years. So I think it was really Dre's first time sitting on a therapist's couch. And I think he liked that challenge. I think he was curious because he never unpacked any of this stuff, any of the violence in his life, whether he suffered at the hands of someone, abuse, what he saw and what he did, you know, he never really processed it. So we're watching him for the first time. No one knows this. I never even talked about this before. I don't think Dre ever talked about this stuff with his family. So what you're seeing in this film, when he's dealing with particularly the D-Barnes situation, the assault in 1991, that's the first time Dre's ever talked about it. And that's the only time he's talked about it.
I expect that there will be people who look at that aspect of the documentary and think, this is someone who we shouldn't be celebrating. This is someone who should be paying for what he's done. Mm-hmm. How do you see that sort of that troubling question that you've got an artist mm-hmm. who's capable of extraordinary things, but then also someone who is quite a troubled person and has really had some really dark episodes in their life?
That's a great, great question. You know, and at the end of the day, any great artist that we look up to, or if we look into their past or who they are, whatever, there's going to be some contradictions in their character. There's going to be some trouble. There's going to be some challenges and some problems. Quality human beings evolve. And even people that have been sent to prison doesn't rehabilitate, but like brilliant people that go in that want to be quality human beings take that, and it's remarkable who they are 20 years from when they get out of prison, you know. So there, you know, when I look at some of my favorite artists and even business people of all time, if you judge them who they were at 22, it's a wrap. I try to always look for honesty in everything, the truth. It's difficult. But that whole thing I just went over about, like, who Dre was and what he did versus who he is now. Now, I'm learning that as I'm making the film. And I'm also learning that about myself. So it's, expedition with a documentary filmmaking, you're in exploratory mode the whole time, and you're learning stuff, and you don't even know where this thing is going. There were times where it was scary, you know, things I'm excavating about him, her, Dre, Jimmy, and it's challenging me, like, oh, I didn't know that, whether it was fantastical or beautiful or tragic. Our job is to paint in such a manner that people make their own mind up.
And The Defiant Ones, as I said, is out on Netflix today. Elsewhere on the streaming service is something that's been warming the hearts of viewers all over the world, Queer Eye. This is a reboot of the lifestyle makeover show Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, which ran through the noughties. Let's hear a clip.
The original show was fighting for tolerance. Our fight is for acceptance.
Let's do this. I'm excited, like I don't know what to expect.
I'd like the Fab Five to help me get out of my comfort zone.
I think my dad is lonely.
I want her to be excited about the new me.
Remy is surviving, and I need him to start thriving.
There's no way that that's acceptable anywhere other than... God, I don't even know where you'd wear that.
A little taste of Queer Eye. Lucy, most people know the premise of this programme, but if they've been living under a rock... let us know how this format works.
Okay, so the premise is quite straightforward. It's a group of five guys. They're called the Fab Five, and they're gay guys, and they all take a different kind of facet of making over someone. So there's grooming, and there's food, and there's style, and there's culture, and they go into someone's life who needs a bit of a makeover, a bit of a pep-me-up, and that's what they do.
And it's really good. And this sort of plays around with a lot of things, because it plays around with gay people's ideas of straight people and straight people's ideas of gay people, and then how you televise that, how you make that natural or artful and unnatural. So there's all sorts of stresses and strains and interesting kind of things going on in the show as well. It's not just kind of like, ha, look at them, they're different.
Yeah,
is it?
It's not like that at all. It's really kind of empathetic, and there's a lot going on. So when they're making over the different people, the five different guys, who by the way all have amazing personalities and like you just love them immediately, they bring their own life experiences and give a kind of window into kind of the queer life experience into the person's life, and then so you get this incredible mixture of themes coming up. So masculinity, obviously a big one in one episode, kind of Black Lives Matter comes up, religion, and one of the guys they go and make over is this kind of evangelical Southern Christian with six kids, and one of them, Bobby, has had like a really difficult upbringing with religion, and they end up talking about it. And it's kind of kind and warm and sweet and basically just a soothing and empathetic
a
kind of universe. It really is.
Yeah.
It's really heartwarming.
Because this is all about, I guess, the casting on both sides, the kind of queer eyes, the experts, and then the subjects as well that they kind of have to make over and advise and all the rest of it. I wonder if you feel that this sort of pitch of this show has changed slightly from being kind of OTT and a bit kind of like kind of queer to being very kind of to being inclusive. And as I say, I think at the beginning of the trailer they say this was about, we originally wanted this to be about tolerance, now we want it to be about acceptance. Is that fair to say? Does it feel like it's kind of the format has moved on a bit, as you hope everybody else might have done?
Yeah, definitely. And I think yes, the people that they make over are clearly chosen because they are kind of representatives of groups that maybe would have been not tolerant of like LGBT communities in the past. However, the acceptance also goes both ways. It's not kind of just about these people being made over, maybe like not knowing and having any gay friends and, you know, dealing with that. It's also the Fab Five kind of accepting them as well, and it all becomes this kind of interesting mix. And it's not kind of cheesy or sentimental, or it doesn't feel forced. And maybe that's, I think, because of the strength of their personalities. When there was so much awful stuff going on in the world, putting it on and seeing people being accepting and inclusive and kind and sweet and warm.
A programme where people end up more confident and happier, and there is a sort of an emotional feedback loop of positivity. Yeah. That's not bad right now.
No.
Queer Eye possibly has the answers. It is currently now on Netflix. And do you know what isn't on Netflix? The only thing that is in our show that isn't on Netflix is your final choice, Toby. Yeah. This is called This Country, and it's on the good old BBC. Shall we have a clip, or do you want to set this one up yourself?
I'll just very, very briefly. It is on the old-fashioned BBC, but the old-fashioned, new-fashioned BBC Three, which is online only.
Oh, God, of course it is.
And which, I mean, it had a channel, had a proper channel, was grown up and everything, and then it moved online, went up into its bedroom, asked for its dinner to be left outside the door.
And its parents said, I think it's time we took the laptop out of your room, Toby.
Yes, they did. No more. We're also going to take that lock off the door as well. This Country is a mockumentary about a pair of cousins, Kerry and Curtin, who live in a small Cotswold village, and it documents their life, or people might say the lack of their life. But it is a mockumentary.
Over there, we saw Lawrence Welland Bowen once, and once in the shop, and once up Burley Hill riding this bike, didn't we?
And in the co-op.
Yeah.
Because I was walking in the co-op, and he was coming out, and I said, after you. And he said, no, after you. He's so humble.
So humble. And I asked him, I said to him, when do we get to see you back on our screens? Because it's a crying shame. We're just not. I don't get to see you as often. And he just shrugged.
He just shrugged like that. Such a shame.
That sounds really good somehow, coming after all those Netflix shows, isn't it? Annihilation and that. Someone needs to write a dissertation. So this is good stuff. This is sort of fake fly on the wall documentary. It's something that's kind of wouldn't have existed without The Office. And in fact, Curtin looks so much like Gareth.
It is incredible.
Like Mackenzie Crook.
It is incredible how similar they look. It could be the early years in some ways, like the prequel or something.
Yeah.
I mean, as we record today, last night, This Country won 3 awards at the Royal Television Society awards for best comedy, scripted, writers and performers, I think, off the top of my head, but it won 3, a hat trick at that. That goes to show the impact it's had within the industry, but also as well, the viewing public have absolutely latched onto this.
And
very much so. And it's only been around a year. I think it came out in February last year. So we're in the middle of series 2 at the moment. Wonderfully, they're releasing it in the old-fashioned way of an episode a week. You're not having to, you don't get all 6 at once. You just tear through it. And I was speaking to Charlie Cooper last night, who was there, who plays Curtin, and he likes that. He likes the fact that you get one a week and you get a chance to think about it and savor it. And he was also saying, and if anyone who watches this is interested, they do go through the social media to see what people are saying about the show, and they found some pretty wild hashtags. Right. And it's kind of weird because then they kind of keep stuff in their heads about what people like and don't like, which he was saying is tricky because obviously you don't want it to start infecting the writing process. But as you said so rightly there, this sort of format couldn't exist without The Office. However, what is different about this is that even though we're talking about two people who are, you would say, from a marginalised community, because it does make a point about rural youth in Britain, how likely it is that they are unemployed, how likely they are to find it difficult to establish a foothold in adult life, if you like. It is not patronising. It doesn't sneer. It doesn't look down upon the characters. It is rather warm, and actually that is such a fine balancing act in these people being really great comedy characters and hostage to their own flaws, but at the same time acknowledging them that they are human beings. And there are human beings not too dissimilar to them out there, which I think, is borne out in the writing time and time again, because you do feel for these people. And, the characters, they have very difficult relationships with their parents and their immediate family. So they Kerry and Curtin fall upon one another to kind of form this family unit. And it is brilliantly acted, and it is, super funny. I mean, if there's one particular episode in the second series about Kerry receiving threatening letters, and it is not what you think, and it really degenerates. And it is... just sort of like howling with laughter funny. But it is, I think it's a really fine export. And these two have, I think, have got such a future.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, the idea of the export, which, not wanting to sort of labour the point of the importance of these things being hits outside of their territory, outside of even their channel, this being on BBC Three and all the rest of it. How important is that? How important is this show to BBC Worldwide, I wonder? And how how much is that built into something when it gets a second series? Does it need to kind of pay its way and be able to kind of go to MIP and make some money?
Yeah, I mean, that's, of course, I'm sure they would love for it to be sold to like 200 territories.
Because I'm wanting to see this with Japanese subtitles, basically, wondering what the rest of the world makes of it.
Well, you would like to, you kind of wonder how that Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen anecdote would go down.
I thought we kind of should explain that to our listeners, many of whom are not in the UK. I think the answer is Google it, listeners. Sorry.
He's a flamboyant builder.
Flamboyant builder. He'd love that.
I think that's pretty much him. I think as we were sort of discussing earlier, the way television is consumed now, it feels ever easier for people abroad to see these kind of British, these works of British television. At no stage, certainly in the second series, do you suddenly start hearing references to Yokohama or Pretoria. and all of a sudden, like, that would really jar.
That would be slightly odd.
That would jar. If anything, it does the second series broaden its universe, but I think with anything...
And by going to Chipping Sodbury or something.
I mean, they almost get the bus. Almost get the bus. I mean, that's kind of how isolated they are. But I think I very often feel that the appeal of British works is within its Britishness, and that's not flag waving fish and chip eating Britishness, which is all well and good, but about a study of the slight nuances of British culture and British personality. Of course, as well, these are all human stories. Struggling to find work, having a difficult relationship with your family. It's just the kind of arena in which it plays out, which differs from.
Exactly.
Show to show.
And I suppose if you can do a comedy about a paper merchant in Slough, which gets bought and made into I don't know how many series in the United States, with a few tweaks, obviously, then this country has a bright future ahead of it, hopefully. But you kind of hope its characters don't, in order that they stay funny and where they are, I suppose.
Well, I mean, you don't want them to be... Do you not want them to suddenly, like, I don't know, they accidentally end up fracking and then find out they're sitting on a shale gas and become billionaires. But at the same time, you also want them to preserve that honesty of them. You hope that continues for a while.
Well, congratulations on your awards, this country. That is streaming on BBC Three. Thank you both. We're going to come back to you at the end with Fernando's global countdown. But first, we're going to take a break, and we're going to speak to Ricky Lee Jones. It's nearly 40 years since Ricky Lee Jones arrived with Chuck E's In Love, a semi-spoken sort of jazz ballad, which would remain her best-known song. Jones's career has since been most things except predictable. Even when waylaid by writer's block, the dual Grammy winner proved herself an adept and audacious interpreter of the songs of others. During a recent trip to the UK, she came by Midori House for a chat with Andrew Miller and played a couple of songs.
It's written by Neil Young. I am a child, I'll last a while. You can't conceive of the pleasure in my smile.
You've interpreted the work of lots of other artists. What is it about a particular song that makes you think, or that leaps out at you enough that you think, I want to sing that?
Sometimes it's a spur of the moment. Sometimes I hear a song and think, that would be a unique interpretation if I sang it because I'm a female or because of what I do or whatever reason. I think the listener will have a very interesting response to it. And also, I'll sing the shit out of it, right? So there's two things about it. The third is, you know, what is my experience when I sing the song? So some are greater than others, but like I describe my own, they're all their own little rooms. I think one of the ones I most delighted in doing was the, please allow me to introduce myself.
Sympathy for the Devil.
Because, you know, that's not only a Rolling Stone song, but it's a song done exactly this way. Woo, woo! People like these little parts of it, and they like a little kid's song, and they want to sing it exactly that way every time they hear it. And so I thought, let's break it down with an acoustic guitar and a woman singing it. What's that like for the people? The first time I did it, and it was also because I recognized that it was truly evoking evil. It was almost a ritual. So the first time I did it was at Carnegie Hall in a tribute to the Rolling Stones. I was wearing a white dress. I sat down with my guitar, and the minute I started, please allow me to introduce myself, I could see a whole wave of the audience move. It felt like they were rejecting it outright. They were going, what is that? But they weren't. They were totally caught. I didn't know what was happening. After the song ended, I could see I had won them. But their first reaction was, you know, what would it be? It'd be like putting Christmas lights on a statue of the Christ or something. You know, it was just like, this is wrong. But once they adjust to the different way of hearing it, they have a new experience of it. And for me, because I don't know how else to, what words to use to describe it, but it's almost like theater for me. I act the songs. I experience them as I am the characters in the song. It's exciting for me. It is kind of like church, but it's also like theater.
Rough up my hair. It's lots of fun to have you there. I gave to you, now you give to me.
The autobiography, which is quite a story by definition, is it finished?
It's not finished. But it's much closer than it has ever been to being finished. I think I finished, you know, the first 25 years quite. It's you know, I've rewritten it now for about 3 years, and I keep returning to the same stories. And so then, the thing about the process of writing about myself, it's totally unlike writing a couple pages about politics, because to find a narrative voice talking about myself is very difficult. It took a long time, you know. So the stories, you know, the stories of my life after I'm famous are fun, but the stories before are like Charles Dickens and my mother's family and my father's family. I think it's, you know, I have to leave a lot out or nobody will believe what's there. It's been an incredible life. You know, my mother grew up in an orphanage and social workers stole her out of the window. And my father was the son of a vaudevillian. We have a wonderful story to tell before I ever even arrived. So I think it'll be a lovely book. And I will finish it this year.
Like it's pretty sleazy when I met him. Just a weasel and a poor boy's wool. A weasel and a poor boy's wool.
That was Ricky Lee Jones talking to Andrew Miller, and now we're going to have this week's Global Countdown. Not the last one ever, though, surely. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, welcome to the programme.
Hello, Rob. Hello, everyone. I'm sure the Global Countdown, we'll be back in some way.
It'll be back with extra echo on it.
Exactly.
It'll be back.
With more number ones than ever.
So you have got an interesting project up your sleeve for this. This is not just any Global Countdown, Fernando. What is today's difference?
Well, this is literally a global countdown in the sense because it's the top tracks of all time in all countries together. There's a company that does track those sort of things, media traffic, and, you know, their official numbers. And I decided, you know, if it's the last one in this format, at least, I said, why not? Let's look at the top five.
Knock it out the park.
But before I start, I want especially for Lucy and to Toby, do you want to guess? I mean, who perhaps do you think might be in the top five?
The Beatles, obviously, the streaming, they're not around much or weren't around much,
true,
were they?
There's no Beatles in there.
Michael Jackson?
No.
Taylor Swift?
I like
Venga
it.
Boys? The Venga Boys?
I wish the Venga Boys would be there. I really wish. I remember. Big fan.
Fernando tried to skew it, but he couldn't quite.
Exactly. Exactly.
Tried to cheat the system. I think you're going to have to let us out of our misery here.
Yeah, let's start to number five. I think it's the most recent of the now as well. And it was quite annoying when it was released, but now I'm okay with it. It's Pharrell Williams with Happy. Because I'm happy.
A Okay, well, I was kind of surprised that that was in the fifth biggest songs of all time.
But let's remember, the year it was released, I think it sold 7 million copies in the US alone.
Wow.
And it was also the soundtrack of Despicable Me 2. And that's a little trend. I don't want to review...
Let's not hold that against it.
Yeah, no, but I'm not going to review too much. But if you're part of a soundtrack, for some reason it helps one way or another. Well, talking about soundtrack, I think we can go smoothly to number 4.
Let's do it.
I think, especially the British, I think they must be very tired of it by now, because the song was 16 weeks at number 1 back in 1991.
I know where we are.
It's of course Bryan Adams. Let's listen to it. Everything I do it for you.
Don't tell me it's not worth trying for. You can't tell me it's not worth dying for. You know it's true. Everything I do it for you.
Oh, that's emotional. So good. Was that 16 weeks or something? 16 weeks in number one.
Yeah,
that's absolutely amazing.
And, you know, and it was not only in the UK, of course, it was the US, because this, we're looking worldwide. And it was the soundtrack, does anybody remember the film?
Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Of course.
That's, it's great.
I think the song's better than the film,
The song's great. Yeah. The song's absolutely great.
Talking about films, we have to move on to number 3.
Of course,
the wonderful and late Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You. Let's listen to a clip.
And I will always love you. I will always love you.
Oh, we were having a bit of a moment here.
Yes.
Fanning ourselves with various bits of paper. It's good, isn't it? I mean, you know, what do we think? What do we think, actually? I mean, you know,
I was wondering how many royalties Dolly Parton gets.
Wow, quite a few.
Because imagine if that was your song, but, you know, someone else had sung it brilliantly and it was the third most listened to song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that era as well? Like, we just had 91 there, 92 with Whitney Houston. Was that just about the peak of CD sales or something? Is that one of the reasons, you know, why they're in this top?
I feel like that was still tapes. 91, 92.
Yeah.
And I think that was the time, especially where airplay kind of dominated the charts, especially in the US. We didn't have so much streaming. And I think radio, you know, they literally refused to stop playing those two songs, Whitney and Brian. And there's another thing that helped, I Will Always Love You, because when Whitney died in 2012, the song returned to the charts. In fact, I think it was number 2 or number 3 in the singles charts in the US this week. We see this all the time when an artist died, come back to the chart. But with Whitney, It was quite special, and it was all over the place as well. But actually, I made a mistake. The most recent song in the top 5 actually is number 2. I think I've been discussing literally every single week when I was here doing the Global Countdown.
The elephant in the room.
It's the elephant in the room with, I have to say, a nice beat, you know.
A nice beat? You sound like my dad.
Yes.
It's got a nice beat, Robert.
Exactly. It's, of course, Ed Sheeran, Shape of You.
Oh, my gosh.
Already the second... Wow. Biggest song ever.
Wow.
We have a clip of it again.
I'm in love with the shape of you. We push and pull like a magnet do. Although my heart is falling too. I'm in love with your body.
When did this song come out?
That was last year.
And it's second of all time.
Insane.
That is literally
because
nuts.
You have to remember, that was the man that changed the rules of the UK charts, because when he released his album last year, basically, I think all the songs were on the top 20 in the UK, and I think they introduced a new rule where you limit the number of songs of an artist. I'm not sure if I agree with this rule, but, you know, they were like, oh my God, the Ed Sheeran effect is a bit too much, as we can see here.
Genuinely, given that song, right, it's the second most played song of all time, how old will he be when all the royalties finally clear, like, and come through to him? He'll have to live to about 130 just to cash all
who knows.
Let's hope so. Who has got the biggest song of all time?
Well, let's listen to it.
Goodbye, England's rose, may you ever grow in our hearts. You were the grace that placed itself where lives were torn apart. Called out to our country, and you whispered to those in pain, now you belong to heaven, and the stars spell out your name.
And the Oscar for Best Eyebrow goes to Elton John.
Elton John, of course, Candle in the Wind, 97, guys.
Wow.
Of course, he changed the lyrics, you know, because the song was a tribute to the late Princess Diana. And,
yeah.
I mean, this song is interesting because people were asking, oh, but wasn't this more kind of a British thing? Not really, actually. The song, I think, sold 11 million copies in the US. I remember I was a kid in Brazil at the time. It was non-stop playing on the radio. So it was a worldwide phenomenon. And I do feel slightly emotional, a little bit. Yeah. You know, it's...
That was definitely the best bit.
But...
Yeah.
It's your emotional response to it. And in when you were growing up in Brazil, was it about Diana? And do you think the people in the US who bought the single, do you think they were responding to the Diana effect too? Or is it just the music? Because, like, I mean, what does it say about us that that song is our most bought song? Is it about Diana or is it?
I think it was about Diana. It's funny to say that because what's the connection of Brazil and Diana in a way? Mm. But I remember my grandma feeling so sad, like, you don't know what happened. You know, and, you know, back in 97, I was very young, but I remember vividly. I think it was almost an experience that everybody in the world had in a way. Mm. It's an interesting phenomenon.
If we had to listen to one of those songs on repeat for the rest of... What would we take with us? I think I'm taking Bryan Adams with me.
I'll be controversial. I think I'll take Elton John.
You're going to take Elton. Lucy.
Whitney.
Toby.
I would take Happy, just so I kind of reach that hysterical level.
Okay.
I'm so sad, but I'm smiling constantly.
Kind of, we've kept our pecker up till the end. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you as ever, Fernando. And thank you both to my guests, Lucy and Toby. Thank you very much indeed. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Thank you, of course, to my guests, Toby Earle and Lucy Jones. As we said at the top of the show, this is the final episode of the Monocle Arts Review. We're launching a new programme called the Monocle Culture Show from Monday, the 2nd of April, which will be the new home of our review. So make sure you tune in then at 7 p.m. For now, the show was produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I've been Robert Bounds. Thank you very much for listening to the Monocle Arts Review over the past few years. For our final play out, we're going to give it up to Elton John. Thanks for tuning in.
And your footsteps will always fall here along England's greenest hills. Your candles burned out long before.